Welcome to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world. This is bonus episode 14. Je me souviens, cultural continuity after the fall of New France. Je me souviens, or I remember, is both the official motto of modern-day Quebec and also the watch phrase acting as the guardian of long-cherished cultural ties. Subsumed into a British and then Canadian nation, Quebec has managed to maintain a distinctive French identity. To illuminate the continuity of the French presence after the English conquest of 1759, scholars often cite the story of Charles Longlad. Born in the straits between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, Charles was delivered into an Anishinaabe world aligned with the French in 1729. He straddled both of these worlds, being of Métis or mixed ancestry. His native mother sought to establish blood ties to the fur trading empire, and his French father had sought the blessing and protection a union like this would afford him. Charles would grow into a coureur de bois of considerable renown by leveraging his diverse roots to beat out his opponents. Learning the ways of La Guerre Sauvage, Charles was commissioned a lieutenant in the Troupe de la Marine and led the ambush against British General Braddock in 1754. In 1757, he was in charge of native forces that participated in the massacre outside of Fort William Henry. Rumor has it that he fired the deadly shot that felled General Wolfe outside the walls of Quebec in 1759. A brave French officer of superior renown, his career would appear to be at an end when New France was transferred to the British in 1763. Instead, we find Longlad first acting to defuse tensions in Pontiac's War by returning captured British soldiers safely to Montreal from the Great Lakes tribes in rebellion. He then pops up as a captain under the command of British Indian Superintendent Sir William Johnson and joins Burgoyne's ill-fated Saratoga expedition in 1777. Finally, we find him fighting American forces under Anthony Wayne in 1794 in the Northwest Territory. Longlad and 95% of the population of New France stayed on in Canada after the British conquest. Deep family and cultural ties to the region, along with protections for both French law and the Catholic religion, allowed many former French Troupe de la Marine to seamlessly transition to British service against the hated Protestant foe during the Revolution. Under British rule, the evolving idea that would become Canada included a French-Canadian identity awareness, was both insulated and accentuated through two further conflicts beyond the fall of Quebec and French royal rule. France wished to forget the episode and instead sought to place blame. 50 major leading figures of New France's elite were indicted on charges of fraud in the L'Affaire du Canada. Former Governor General Vaudreuil and the last Royal Intendant Bigot topped the list of mostly former prominent colonial marine commanders who were accused of using their extended native and Canadian-born family kin groups in the fashion of a unified cartel. French royal prosecutors attempted to use the native alliance system of copious gift-giving as a backdoor for corruption insinuations. Many were accused of using wide personal liberty when executing official diplomatic missions. The trials took place from 1760 to 1763, and many spent anywhere from several months to 3 years in the Bastille. Only the intendant Bigot was found guilty and forced to pay a very large fine. Most former Troupe de la Marine were let off with judicious circumspect in the form of warnings. The key to a smooth transition is the British imperial system. The various sects and peoples that populated the New World reached to over 2 million before the Revolution, each colony being extremely jealous, competitive, and willing to throw each other under the bus for land. The British imperial system, especially after the French and Indian War, had sufficiently melded these disparate and competing political entities into a second pillar of a new transatlantic empire. British America would have joined the UK and eventually eclipsed it within the Union if a series of complicated geopolitical events didn't irrevocably break those fraternal bonds. Much of it has to do with British imperial land policy, such as the Proclamation Line of 1763 and the Quebec Act of 1774. Quebec and other periphery British territories outside the eastern seaboard were looking for great stability in the new status quo post-1763 settlement. The French had little desire to reclaim Canada during the Revolution, showing the same lack of enthusiasm demonstrated at the end of the French and Indian War, when Canada was offered back to them in 1763, but bartered away for Madras. British settlement in favor of residents born in the Isles tweaked the New England colonies, who saw Nova Scotia as theirs by right of blood and treasure. The French sought advantage in the Caribbean during the Revolution and traded for India again in 1783. If Canada was French-controlled, then American independence would have not been a fait accompli. American colonial participation in the feats of arms during the Seven Years' War was seen as directly being stampeded upon by the Quebec Act. The bête noire, especially for New England, would still exist, and much closer cooperation would be seen between colonists and British officials. American revolutionaries saw Canadian participation in the Union as so inevitable that a direct clause was included in the Articles of Confederation. A Catholic population led by royalist French officials and priests, pitted against reactionary and land-hungry Protestant expansionists of New England, would have been at each other's throats for years. Remember, almost the entire French population of Acadia was removed and replaced by their neighbors to the south. Instead of a Catholic-Protestant rivalry, the Quebec Act of 1774 helped provide a smoother transition into the British imperial system by establishing the autonomy needed for the Francophone community to continue to thrive. The allowance of French civil law, language, Catholic primacy, and confirmation of seigneurial estates calmed the simmering tensions that could have led the Quebecois to partner with the American rebels to the south over a decade later. Confirmation of the newly British Francophone subjects' rights angered the American colonists to the south, who viewed themselves as the premier pan-Atlantic basin partner. Britain saw the need to balance this vast new imperial empire, while Americans expected the rise in prominence and resultant awards from their participation. This was truly a mismatched set of expectations and placement on the power ranks within the imperial system. As the intra-war years dragged on, with friction increasing between Britain and America, the Quebecois and their familial connections to the natives of the High Country were increasingly viewed as a hedge against North American rebellion. The Quebecois still feared their Protestant New England neighbors to the south and saw the British imperial government as a guarantor against persecution. Given the geopolitical needs of the British Empire and the skills possessed by the Quebecois, the Quebec Act was a match of convenience that served both parties. One final cultural illustration of the continuity and lingering connections within the greater Francophone world is the story of the loup-garou, or werewolf outbreak, experienced during the intra-war years across the Atlantic basin. France had experienced a famous outbreak of loup-garou sightings between the years of 1764 to 1767 that are collectively known as the Beast of Gévaudan. The French royal court applied considerable funds and manpower to hunt down this legendary creature. 30,000 soldiers and hunters combed the countryside in an attempt to staunch the unnatural violent occurrences. Close to 100 confirmed victims and several hundred attacks were attributed to the beast. Royal agents were able to corner and slay a monstrous wolf pair and their cub, but attacks continued. Another large wolf was also slain a year later by a local farmer, but mysteriously the attacks ceased in France, but picked up across the ocean in the former colony of Quebec. For a year, sightings were reported up and down the St. Lawrence River Valley, but the beast was never cornered or killed. The loup-garou disappeared from official public scrutiny after 1767, but the cultural imprint remains. Quebecois folklore was a syncretic variant enriched by both European Catholicism and New World Native beliefs. Native concepts like shape-shifting and horrible syncretic creatures, such as the Wendigo, lent substance to Old World tales of superstition. Cultural objections to the consumption of human flesh in the form of Native American rituals also played a large role. Whether traveling to the Americas or Africa, Europeans feared being eaten. While actual cannibalism for subsistence was very rare, widespread ritual torture and display of executed foes could be witnessed. From the Aztec to the Iroquois, captives were sacrificed and exhibited as displays of power. The same behavior can be witnessed in European practices of quartering or slow starvation of opponents in cages. The deprivation of proper burial and intimidation of other enemies was the goal. While Europeans usually treated their criminals in such manner, New World societies developed great and solemn religious ceremony for their sacrificial displays. The practice found new expression in the concept of scalping, in which the participant was then paid by the overall number taken. One last detail to take into account is the outside pressure of war that was afflicting both France and Quebec at the time of these sightings. Might the sudden outbreak of this phenomenon be related to some sort of widespread trauma caused by conflict? Is it possible that the people of Quebec were subliminally seeking to re-establish French cultural affinity after the recent War of Conquest? Thanks for listening to New York, Quebec, and the Water Route to the Center of the World.